Are you happy? Are you healthy? Are you optimistic? Do you experience satisfaction in most of your daily life? Now let me ask those questions another way. Do the things you buy make you happy? Do they contribute to your health? Do they bring you satisfaction? Finally, if you look around and you look inside, how many of you believe more is better? Bill McKibben was one of the first to write about global warming as far back as 1989. He's written about population, environmental destruction, and cultural anxiety. In his new book, Deep Economy, he pulls a lot of those ideas together in challenging the prevailing view of our economy. He claims that for the first time in human history, more is no longer synonymous with better. Indeed, for many of us, he believes they've become almost opposites. He wants you to think in new ways about the things you buy, the food you eat, the energy you use, and the money that pays for it all. He's also taken on more than writing about our problems. He's one of the founders of StepItUp2007.org, calling for a National Day of Climate Action, April 14th, 2007. Bill McKibben graduated from Harvard in 1982 and immediately was hired as an editor at the New Yorker magazine. That's a big success. However, at the age of 26, dissatisfied with the frantic pace of urban life and work, he quit his job at the New Yorker, moved with his wife to an isolated house. The nearest town is 12 miles away, in the Adirondack Mountains in New York State. There, his concern over the growing threat to the Earth's ecosystem posed by chemical pollution led him to the research and the reflections described in his book, The End of Nature, which sounded one of the earliest alarms about global warming. In a later book, Maybe One, he took on the most controversial of environmental problems, population. Other books include $100 Holiday, The Age of Missing Information, Hope, Human and Wild, and his newest, Deep Economy. McKibben is a writer in residence at Middlebury College and a frequent contributor to a wide variety of publications, including the New York Review of Books, Outside, the New York Times, and Mother Jones. Welcome, Bill McKibben.
Terry, it's always good to be with you.
Thank you. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas. So, what, at this point, what do you think you are? Are you still a writer? Are you an environmentalist? Are you a social change agent? Are you a dad?
Well, I guess I'm some of all of that. I've been making the transition slowly from being mostly a writer, which is what I started out being, to much more over time of an activist. But it all comes for me out of the writing that I do and out of the research that goes into it. I think mostly what I am is intensely curious about the world, and I like to get out and see what people are doing and see what interesting things are happening and find what embers there are out there and kind of blow on them and try to help spread some of those ideas a little far and wide.
And it seems to me that, is this the book that's the most environmental since End of Nature?
Well, in some sense, everything I've written has flowed from the basic idea of the end of nature, which is that we're going to need to change pretty dramatically to cope with environmental challenge on a scale that human civilization has never seen. I mean, there's nothing we've ever done as big as global warming and as decisive and as threatening to all the things that we hold to be normal about our lives. And in one way or another, all that I've written is about that. But this, finally, I think, is an attempt to get at the maybe the deepest nub of that, which is a lot to do with our economic lives, with how we understand ourselves, why we consume the ways we do, and how we might do it more differently and with more pleasure.
It looks to me like two things came together in your arrival and producing this book, which is the heightened danger, and then this whole new field of research. I don't think it's just that the that what they're finding out is new. What they're even looking at is new in terms of finding out whether we're happy or not. Could you talk about that?
You want me to talk first about some of the ecological stuff? Or?
I'll take the ball from you and just say, I think most people listening to this show know about peak oil, know about global warming, know about pollution.
I think by this point, if there are people out there who don't believe in global warming, say, they're suffering from a kind of ideological block that I'm unlikely to remove in the course of a few minutes. So This other challenge to our more is better infinite growth model is more subtle and more interesting. It really is the default assumption of our society that more is better. And if you have any doubt of that, turn on the evening newscast and listen to the very objective, neutral newscaster come to the economic news and say, good news on the economic front today, the gross domestic product grew 4%. And he never comes on and says, ooh, troubling news on the economic front today, housing starts are up 12%. That's always good news, even though most of us are beginning to have some inkling of an idea why that might at least be a shaded piece of information. About 10 years ago, economists and sociologists began trying to really figure out whether there were ways to assess directly whether or not people were very satisfied with their lives.
Adam Smith, who everyone sort of goes to, is starting the whole thing. He wrote a book on moral sentiments, which I believe he said was the book he most cared about.
Absolutely. But economics, as it had grown up, had sort of gotten away from that, considered that a very squishy and soft way of doing things, and argued that their concept of utility was broad enough to cover all these bases. Basically, that you could tell what made someone happy by what they bought. Okay? They began to try to figure out if it was possible to ask people directly whether or not the answer that you would give to the question, are you happy, was a meaningful one or not. And this took a lot of work, you know. But eventually, people became pretty well persuaded that that subjective well-being was a robust phenomenon, i.e., that if you told me you were happy, that correlated with how other people saw you. It correlated with certain measurable things in your brain chemistry. It was useful data. Once we had that data, we could start asking very subversive questions, like we could go back and look at a polling set that one of the big national polling firms has done every year since the end of World War II. When they ask people, are you happy or not? The number of Americans who say, I'm very happy, peaks in 1956 and goes slowly downhill ever since. Now, only about a quarter of Americans will say, I'm very happy now, which is very strange.
And that peak, as I recall, was up at about 38%.
Something like that. I mean, and frankly, I find it quite annoying since that was 4 years before I was born and I missed whatever party was underway. But that curve that it's going down is very odd because, of course, in that same 50 years, we each have about three times as much stuff as we used to. Our material standard of living has about trebled. If the economy worked the way that we believe intuitively it works, those should move in somewhat the same direction. And it's my contention and the contention of this new book that it's not just that they coincidentally move apart. It's that that affluence has something to do with that dissatisfaction. When we try to figure out why people are feeling less happy about their lives, it seems to be deeply connected to a sense of loss of social connection, a loss of community. What did we start spending that money on in the 50s? We started buying bigger houses and moving further out to the suburbs, and we bought the first of the set of screens that we've been assiduously peering into ever since. Those two things have mathematically reduced, you know, the chance that we're going to run into anybody else in the course of a day.
Those two things being?
The fact that we're living further and further apart.
The suburbs, the car.
And that we're watching television 4 hours a day.
Or a computer screen,
yeah,
or now a telephone. Yeah.
Right. And, in fact, the average number of close friends that Americans have has fallen by half in that period. The amount of time, number of times that we eat dinner with friends and family and relatives has fallen by something like half. And those falls turn out to be more important than the rise, you know, than the fact that we have twice as many square feet in our homes, or that we take twice as many vacations by jet, or that we, you know, have eight times as many electronic appliances. Those aren't compensation, it turns out, for this loss of connection.
Let me ask a little more of a background
question.
Please. I'm sorry to interrupt, but for people to whom this whole field is new, that this isn't just one or two folks saying this. The thing I was most impressed or surprised with was how large this field is. I mean, didn't someone win a Nobel Prize?
Daniel Kahneman from Princeton won the Nobel Prize for work that touches on this stuff. He wrote a book called Hedonics, the attempt to sort of start a systematic study of pleasure and satisfaction. You know, it's a really important emerging set of ideas. And one of the reasons that it's growing so fast is because it intuitively makes sense to people when they hear it. Intuitively makes sense to them in a way that the concept of utility, the idea that you can tell what makes you happy by what you buy, doesn't really intuitively make sense to any of us. We all know in our own lives that that's at best a very approximate notion of what causes us pleasure.
One thing I did want to say so that people don't go, well, this sounds like what you're saying works if you're rich or upper middle class. In other words, one thing that they have found, if I'm not mistaken, is that up to a certain point, and let's say back when they were inventing these theories 100, 200 years ago, being able to purchase something more did make
you happy. Oh, absolutely. I mean, part of the book set in China, where I've done a lot of reporting in the last little while. You go out to rural China, well, people have community coming out their ears. I mean, there's 8 people living in their room, you know, and a little more income, which allows you to, like, build another 100 square feet and maybe have room where just you and your wife and your kid are going to live, is a big deal, and it really helps, you know, and you get a light bulb, and you can, you know, stay up at night reading, and that's really nice, and, you know, so on and so forth. We've passed that point now, most of us in this culture. We've passed this tipping point. We've overshot. For me, since I live in a college town, the analogy to me is, you know, I watch freshmen arrive. In the first weekend of freshman year, they discover that drinking 3 or 4 bottles of beer makes them feel good. And the second weekend of freshman year, they discover that drinking 23 bottles of beer doesn't actually make you feel 4 times better, you know? They've overshot. Well, somewhat the same here. Yeah, there's a point at which acquisition and accumulation and consumption is a very useful thing. And there's a point at which it no longer is. And we're at that point.
And we, most developed countries?
Yeah. Most of the data shows that about past something like $10,000 per capita per year, the correlation between more income and more satisfaction breaks down, and there's just a kind of scattering of points.
Right,
of course,
and that is per capita, so yeah, that's for a family of 4, that'd be $40,000.
And of course, it's a lot easier in most countries because they take the pains to provide you with things like health care, you know, or education, or they allow you to retire if you're not rich.
It doesn't come out of that 10 or 40. Yeah.
Exactly right. And we've built a uniquely bad system in that regard, you know.
So in this country where, let's say, we've been, to some extent, the leader in acquisition, the leader in consumption, the leader in individualism, some even would say it's genetic in that we're the ones that, or we're descended from the ones who risked it all to cross the ocean. Now, it seems like there are feedback loops or something that aren't getting us the right information, that this momentum of individualism and consumption and growth and the GDP equaling happiness, etc., seems to have its own momentum. How do we break that?
I think that the way we break it, and maybe the only way to break it, is to try to figure out how to put more community back into our lives. And by that, I do not mean sort of preaching about community and what a nice thing it would be to see your neighbors, whatever. I mean rebuilding the local economic institutions that are the thing that allow us to have some real interaction and real dependence with our neighbors. And we can start down the list of what those are. I mean, the classic case, the most obvious commodity, is food. At the moment, Americans, they order takeout from 2,000 miles away every night of the year,
I
on
believe
average.
The statistic I've quoted before, I haven't checked it recently, but I think it's 1,300 miles is the average distance food took to get to your place.
It's actually gone up in the last few years. It's even higher than that now. And that has many effects. It clearly is one of the things that drives out of control climate change. It takes an unbelievable amount of energy to move back east. If I want to eat lettuce this time of year, it comes from the Central Valley, California. By the time it reaches where I live, to bring 1 calorie of that lettuce back there took 36 calories of fossil energy. That's not a very inspiring ratio. But that's only half the thing. You know, it's also that if you can begin to substitute some other ways of doing this, you get big social change too. Farmers markets are the fastest growing part of the food system in our food economy in our country. They're growing 10, 12% a year. And with good reason. Not only are they offering good food and tasty food and all of that, they offer a different social experience. A pair of sociologists followed shoppers last year, first around supermarkets, then around farmers markets. You know the supermarket experience.
I know both of them.
You walk in.
I shop at a farmer's market every Saturday.
Well, you walk in, you fall into a light trance, you visit the same stations of the fluorescently lit cross around the supermarket, you end up with the same basket of items, you maybe discuss paper or plastic on the way out. I walk down the street here today in Los Angeles to the farmer's market by the public library, and it was, it wasn't like that. It was a buzz, people talking to farmers, people arguing about what was good in produce and what wasn't, all kinds of fun going on.
Well, isn't the statistic you're 10 times more likely to engage in a conversation?
You engage in 10 times more conversations in each visit to the farmer's market. That's building real community. Something like 10 times less energy being used to feed you, and something like 10 times more community being built. You can do the same argument for a lot of commodities, for energy itself, which we should be figuring out, and we can figure out how to provide more in the way that, more on the model of the internet than of the TV, with everybody putting in and taking out.
In other words, the more we move to solar cells, hydrogen storage, and so on.
I have solar panels on my roof,
Even in Vermont.
When the sun comes out, I'm a utility. I push electrons down the grid. My neighbor's fridge runs off the sunlight falling on my shingles, Then when the cloud passes over, I suck energy from the grid like everybody else.
So the farmer's market's one way. Energy, you're already demonstrating.
Even ephemeral things, like, say, to use one of your hometown industries, entertainment. All of us around the country are very used to the idea that, music is something that comes in a hard-to-open plastic box from Los Angeles or Nashville, And sometimes the people who run this industry say that if people, say, illegally trade files, it will remove all incentive for people to make music, and sort of theoretically music will disappear. That seems unlikely. Human culture has been marked by music for a long time. One of the statistics that I found in this book that I really like was at the turn of the century, 1900, in Iowa, in the state of Iowa, there were 1,300 opera houses, 1,300 live music venues. Nobody heard the greatest singer on earth, and nobody got Whitney Houston rich out of this, but a lot of tenors made part of their living. And everybody heard music in the kind of context of their community and shared it with their neighbors and things. There's some real possibilities here for a more interesting and more sustainable world than the one we're building at the moment.
Right. When you link some of what you're just saying with Chris Anderson's book, The Long Tail, about that there is a market for everything, and that the problem used to be not enough shelf space, not enough discs. Well, once we begin to sell entertainment as digital information or exchange, that ephemeral nature works in our favor. I mean, we mentioned Buckminster Fuller before we started. He was the one that said that ephemeralization is where the direction we should be going.
But the real trend, I think, and say in the music industry, the only people who are really making money now are doing live music performance. And the reason that people want to do that is because they want that social connection as much as they want to consume the music. It's the kind of opposite of the white earbud iPod cocoon, and it's where we need to go.
Oh, so what you're saying is both. In other words, sell some of the music digitally, and that doesn't take as much energy, and
that's what
perform
we, yeah,
live.
That's fine, but it's the sort of
because the kind performing of live
local
gives you
music,
community.
It's the local music that I think is where we're going to probably end up going more and more and more, just because it's more fun.
I'm going to move finally to the part about Step It Up.
Yes.
and what happened to that. But if there's any one other thing that really surprised you in researching this book, writing this book, or meeting people to talk about this book.
What surprised me was how much of this stuff is going on sub rosa around the country. We think that it's all about Walmart, but farmers markets are growing faster than Walmart. We think it's all about, Sony Universal, but live music is growing faster than record sales are. It's really interesting to see the amount of stuff that's already underway. And if we could ever bring the government in on the side of the small and the local and the human instead of on the side of the huge and the corporate, then we would have a chance to ramp it up fast enough to make a difference in some of these ecological problems.
I'll give you my quick notion on that, which is that everyone talks about the Kennedy-Nixon election was the one that where TV became determining and that that was the big change. I think the big change was when TV advertising, which was probably two or three elections later, when TV advertising became the leverage point of elections, then the cost of running shot through the roof, and that's where suddenly activist, you know, folks in the town didn't matter nearly as much
and
as
that's
the contributors.
That's what we're going to change, and that's what we are starting to change, I think, and this Step It Up thing that we're doing is a perfect example.
Okay, so talk about Step It Up, because there's two questions here. One we don't have time to get into, which is how are we going to make the country shift to localism? We've talked a bit about that, but Step It Up isn't so much about that, is it? What is Step It Up about, and how did it happen?
Two things. It happened out of my despair at the fact that nothing was going on about global warming at all.
The Inconvenient Truth?
Well, everybody had seen the movie, which is wonderful. Everybody had seen Hurricane Katrina, which was awful, and there was no political action. You know, James Inhofe was still running the Senate committee telling people that global warming was a hoax, on and on and on. And there'd never been any movement around global warming. We organized in Vermont last summer a rally that drew 1,000 people. And the newspapers the next day said, I don't know if that's true or not, the newspapers the next day said this was the largest rally on climate change that had ever been in the country, you know? So this January, working with six college kids from Middlebury, where I teach, we launched this website called StepItUp07.org or StepItUp2007.org. Either will do. And we asked people to organize rallies in their local communities for April 14th around this call for Congress to cut carbon emissions 80% by 2050. Now, we had no money and no organization, and all we had was a sort of hope that we might, with a lot of hard work, be able maybe to organize 100 of these rallies, because that would be 100 more than there had been before. Instead, because people really are desperate to do something about this, this thing has taken off like a shot. As of today, there's 1,200 and some of these things scheduled in all 50 states of the union. We've got a dozen or two congressmen and senators who have promised to come speak at these things. It's going to be the largest day of grassroots environmental protest since Earth Day 1970. And one of the interesting parts of it, of course, is that it's not a march on Washington, which is the sort of old model, the sort of centralized model of doing this. We didn't want to do that because, A, we couldn't. We didn't have the money or skill. Two, we didn't want to send people spewing carbon across the continent to get to D.C. Three, we really wanted people in their home places. And against the backdrops, like here in Los Angeles, there are going to be people hiking up to the Hollywood sign. There's going to be half a dozen things happening right around the L.A.
And
area.
And to find out about them, they go to that website. Anyone in the country, go to StepItUp07 or StepItUp2007.org and find out what's happening.
And there's this amazing map that I don't know how it works because I'm not very good at this
one
stuff.
One of those
but
six Middleburg
kids are good at it,
yeah.
Yes, and it tells you how to go. But the point is that, you know, now we can do this. We can have people in their local communities doing things with their neighbors, and then using the internet we can link those together. By the end of the day, we're going to have photographs of all 1,200 or however many of these rallies there turn out to be. We're going to have them sort of cascade of images across the web, and we're going to be showing them in Washington that night to political leaders and others, and I'm going to testify in Congress on the next Tuesday and show these images again. And you don't have to choose anymore between the local, the community, the neighborhood, the small town, the city block, and the world.
So that is taking advantage of the technology and the advances we've made.
We've all got a window open on the world now through the net, and that breeze will keep blowing, and it'll blow out the old prejudices and things that have always been the bane of local living. But it will allow that kind of tight community to still exist that we really want. And this StepItUp07.org thing is a perfect example, I think, of where we're headed.
Okay, we've come to the end of the time. So again, the websites are BillMckibben.com and StepItUp2007.org. The book is Deep Economy. Go to StepItUp2007.org. Get involved in something on the 14th. And thank you, Bill McKibben, and keep up the good work.
Terry, thank you.